Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. This show, we're going to spend the hour with one of my favorite guests, Rafe Esquith, who's been teaching fifth graders in LA's Hobart Elementary Public School, coming up on 30 years. And now a master teacher, a teacher of teachers. I know he recently returned from doing that in China, and we'll try to talk a bit about that. I first learned of Rafe's work in 2005. When POV, the PBS film series, pitched me a documentary, The Hobart Shakespeareans, about the full folio Shakespeare productions that his students, most from families where English is not the primary language, perform each year, fifth graders. The doc was directed by Mel Stewart, a wonderful director of at least two landmark films, the 1971 Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder, and 1973's Wattstax concert film of funk music and black power. Mel Stewart passed away a little less than a year ago, August last year, and he is missed. Introducing my interview with Mel Stewart and Rafe Esquith back in September 2005, which I reread as I was preparing, I came upon this, and I'm going to read it to you again. So this is from the intro from 8 years ago. I said this about the documentary of life in Room 56. Documentaries may be giving us what we hunger for. March of the Penguins, Mad Hot Ballroom, and the Hobart Shakespeareans are documentaries about goodness, dedication, and purpose. And whether penguins or fifth graders, they're about respect and treating others well. Each of these films made me giggle, and each brought me to tears. There's something joyfully and painfully touching when we see the life force in action with purpose. When so much is going wrong, from Iraq to New Orleans, I think we need to see these things. 8 years later, that's the end of my quote. 8 years later, Rafe Esquith continues to lead fifth graders at Hobart Elementary, one of the nation's largest inner-city grade schools, through an uncompromising curriculum of English, mathematics, geography, literature. His classroom mottos are, be nice, work hard, and there are no shortcuts. Despite language barriers and poverty, many move on to attend outstanding colleges. Esquith expects the best from these kids, no matter what their backgrounds, and he backs up that expectation by giving them the educational resources to defy the odds. I'm going to read a brief quote from Rafe. I don't want my students to be ordinary. I want them to be extraordinary because I know that they are. If a 10-year-old who doesn't speak English at home can step in front of you into a scene from Shakespeare, then there's nothing he cannot accomplish. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, obviously education. And it's all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Rafe Esquith grew up in Los Angeles and attended the city's public schools. His teaching has earned him the Walt Disney American Teacher Award for National Teacher of the Year, Parents Magazine's As You Grow Award, Oprah Winfrey's Use Your Life Award. He donates his award money to fund the Hobart Shakespeareans. In 2003, he received the National Medal of Arts. He's the author of There Are No Shortcuts, Changing the World One Kid at a Time, Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire, Lighting Their Fires, and his latest, Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. Welcome back to Free Forum, Rafe Esquith.
Appreciate being here. Thank you, good sir.
And as you know, Rafe, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So briefly, tell us a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, I love the fact that you said path, because I love the fact that I've written this book after 30 years of experience. It's funny, the Washington Post just interviewed me, and they loved this because they said, most teachers who write a second book or a third book, they simply rehash what they said in their first book. But I'm not the same person I was 30 years ago. I've learned a lot. And one of the things I like about this book, that path is filled with mistakes and really bad days. And no, because I'm trying to be a real teacher here. And sadly, there's a bitter joke going amongst teachers these days in this path. And this book was written because, if you didn't know this, if your listeners aren't aware, good teaching is becoming an endangered species. The best teachers are leaving the profession in droves. And it's not because the children are any worse. We've always had tough kids to work with. It's not because of poverty. We've always dealt with that. But the system itself is crushing good teachers, leading them to the bitter joke, those that can teach and those that can't make rules for teachers. And people in my profession, very good people, people who have spent 15, 20 years changing lives, are throwing in the towel saying, I can't do this anymore, given the rules being thrown at me, being that my creativity has been taken away from me. And I've written Real Talk to try and show them I'm a very ordinary guy, but I still find ways to beat the system. And I think our students need us more than ever. And when you talk about a path, I think I'm a wiser teacher than I was when I was starting out. I never fight the system because I don't think it can be beaten. It's a path where you work around the system quietly. And I'm kind of a quiet rebel, and I'm trying to share my ideas with my fellow teachers.
Very good. Now, it's interesting because as I recall in some of the earlier books and some of my earlier conversations with you, this kind of coming right out at the top of this interview and saying the system's a problem didn't happen in those. Has something changed in the system or in you?
The system is definitely different, and any teacher will tell you that. It's worse. We are now obsessed with standardized testing, where a teacher's entire year is spent trying to prepare kids to regurgitate a bunch of facts and bubble them circles at the end of the year as though that is supposed to reflect real scholarship and thinking. You know, I always joke with my own students that my wife didn't fall in love with me because of my test scores. I don't know, Terrence, a good teacher that doesn't think we should assess our kids. Of course we should. If I teach my kids to multiply, I'm going to give them an assessment to see if they can do it. But I also tell the children that if they don't do well, it just means I have to show them again. They're not going to burn in hell. The sun is still going to come up tomorrow. It's just a test. That's all it is. But we've made these tests the be-all and end-all of existence, where people go to meetings and are told this is how you will spend every moment of your day, where the only thing we teach has to be on the test. God forbid if a kid wants to talk to you about a real problem he's having at home, if his father is alcoholic, if he's getting beaten by somebody who's got a temper at home. We don't have time to talk about those issues because it's not on the test. That's absurd. And the system has very much changed with this pressure on teachers.
Wow. You know, it's funny because I sort of have seen that growing so gradually that to see how it's affected you impresses me. You actually, one of the appendixes in your book, Real Talk for Real Teachers, you take them through a day. And let me just ask you, how does that day measure up against the formulas you've been given by the system?
Well, of course, I do everything the system asks me to do, Terrence. I go to the meetings, I nod my head and say thank you very much and thank you for your sagely advice. And by the way, these meetings are run by people who could not teach my class to save their lives. That's what all good teachers know. But what I also tell the children is that to take these tests, they are part of a broken system. They should take these tests. They should try to do well on the tests, with the understanding, though, that there are other issues far more important. These tests do not ask children if they are honest, decent, if they're going to be good neighbors one day, if they are discovering things for which they have passion that they want to work real hard on, whether it's gardening or mathematics or playing baseball or being a mechanic. You know, the other obsession we have with college, I know some very happy former students who never went to college, didn't want to go to college. They have wonderful families. They're machinists doing incredible work and probably making more money than we are. So I have those kinds of conversations with my children because I'm a real teacher.
Yeah. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Rafe Esquith, fifth grade teacher at Hobart Elementary in L.A. for nearly 30 years. We're talking about his latest book, Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. You can learn more at HobartShakespeareans.org. That's H-O-B-A-R-T, and then Shakespeareans. I'll leave you to look up on your own. HobartShakespeareans.org. Okay. I want to go back a little bit. When I asked you about your path, you accelerated sort of into that sprint at the end of what's the bee under your bonnet these days.
Fair enough.
You say that you became a teacher because your father taught you that a life without service is a wasted life. Could you talk to us a little about that? And also what it speaks to, Rafe, is the fact that after best-selling books and so on, you're still showing up in that classroom.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, I was raised in that family of service. My father was a social worker, and actually my father was called by the McCarthy Committee and would not name names. I still get letters from people in their 80s and 90s thanking me. I can't tell you what that means to me. That my father, who never got to see me teach because he died when I was 9.
Oh.
And I do think that has a lot to do with why I'm a teacher. I know what it's like to be a young guy who doesn't have a male figure in their life. And I had a great mom. But everybody out there knows moms and dads are different. They have different roles in a family. And I miss having a guy show me how to throw a curveball and things like that. And I try to provide that for a lot of the boys in my class who also don't have dads growing up. And I am a bit of a father figure with some of those guys. There's no question about it. I think, you know, I wrote the book and I divided it into three sections. And the first section, you know, that you're talking about, those early years, which in the book I call Once Upon a Time, I really want young teachers to understand that they're going to have bad days, because these kids, and Terrence, I meet so many of them, they're good kids. And they really, one day they can be really good teachers, but not yet. Nobody's a great teacher.
Oh, that's interesting. Of course, when you said these kids are really good kids, I thought you were talking about the kids. Well, you're talking about the kids and the teachers.
When you're 22 years old, to me, you're a kid. I'm almost 60, okay? And the point is that they go to these meetings and they're told, you are going to save every kid. And then they watch the Hollywood movie and everybody loves the teacher. And they all win the big game at the end, cue the music. And then it doesn't happen in their classrooms and they become discouraged. And they think they're failing or they're bad teachers. And I want them to know, you mentioned all those honors that I have, those silly honors. You know, it's nice meeting the Queen and the Dalai Lama. But I want them to know I screw up all the time after 30 years. So that when they mess up as young teachers, it doesn't mean they're bad. It means that this is a really hard job. And I want them to see that longer picture that you're describing. But I think it takes at least 5 years simply to even understand what the heck you're trying to do in your classroom. No amount of preparation or effort can prepare you for what can go wrong in a classroom, whether you're a kindergarten teacher or an 11th grade physics teacher. Things do go wrong, but we teachers with experience can put them back together. And I'm trying to show the exact path in this book that you talked about. The middle part of the book, which is called Growing Up, is once you sort of have it down, now what are you going to do? How are you going to get better? Because in professional development meetings, it's simply a bunch of rules and regs that they throw at you. Nobody gets better from those meetings. And I know the teachers listening are laughing bitterly. Terrence, I'll tell you how bad these meetings are. I had a dear friend who was dying of cancer. And Tuesdays were our staff meetings. And Tuesday nights, he had to go to some incredibly painful chemotherapy. And he told me he looked forward to the chemotherapy because it meant that the worst was over. That's how bad these meetings can be. But I know that the best teachers, and I did this as a young man, when they have time, they watch other good teachers, because you always hear about the bad teachers, and there are bad teachers. Everybody knows that. But there are also wonderful teachers that you never hear about, whose name is never in the paper.
People who never win awards.
Never win awards. And trust me, they're every bit as good as I am, probably better. I'm just a lucky guy. These people go into their rooms and change lives every day creatively and with real warmth and humor, and where the kids feel safe and excited to come to school. And I love watching those teachers. And I really encourage young teachers, when you have that afternoon off or a day off, go watch these great teachers. That's where you're going to learn. And the wonderful thing about these great teachers, they love sharing themselves. Almost all my good ideas came from watching masters, people that were much better than I was at getting a child from A to B. And it takes years to grow up. As I've written in the book, you might be a great third-year teacher, but that doesn't mean you're a great teacher yet. You're just great for a third-year teacher. I think it took me at least 10 years to even figure out what I wanted my students to look like.
Let me ask you a question about that, because you mention in at least one of your books a turning point when you realize that you were a pretty good teacher and you were a teacher that kids liked.
Yeah.
You know, two for two there. But you realize you weren't making the difference you needed to make in their lives. And I'm curious, at what point in your teaching career did that happen?
It was two parts, and it's a great question. You know, we're told now that the test at the end of the year is where we measure our success. That's absurd. I had kids that did very well at the test at the end of the year, and I would pat myself on the back, good job, Rafe. But then I would hear 3 years later, these same kids were in gangs or making terrible decisions and had messed up their lives. And I thought, well, then what the heck does that mean? Because I learned, Terrence, that the real assessment is where are the kids 10 years later? What skills have I given them, not for the test, but that they're going to use in their lives? So once I figured out that important question, then I had to come up with the answer of how you get there. And the second part to your question is, people ask me, you ask me, who are my mentors? Who are my best teachers? Actually, my best teacher was a former student. And we're very close now. I just saw her at a book signing the other day with her husband and baby. It's just, I can't even tell you how cool that was.
By the way, let me just cut in for a second. This is Terrence Please. McNally. As I think you know, I started out as a school teacher myself.
Right.
And taught in Massachusetts for a few years and then got, you know, seduced. I was going to come out here and reach larger audiences. But when I came out here, my first part-time job while I was going to acting classes and acting auditions was also as a teacher at a school for difficult kids. And I can remember when I would be in a Toys R Us or something and run into one of those kids with their two kids.
Unbelievable.
It's just...
It's the best. I agree. But I had a student in the 90s who, I didn't know it at the time, no one knew it, was a musical prodigy, one of the best pianists in California, but never told anybody because she was so humble that she, when I asked her what was her goal in music, are you going to compose for movies or write songs? And she said, no, this is a 10-year-old. She said, my goal is to advance music. That I see your face. That's what my face was. This was a kid who played music because she loved it. That was the only thing. She didn't need trophies, and she had them. She didn't need recognition. She could have had, you know, all the recognition in the world. She was my vision. Okay, I get it. Let's be intrinsic learners. Let's understand.
Well, let me, because I've read that moment in your book, and you're leaving out one point, which is that you didn't find it out.
Right.
Except that in a moment, she pointed out that there you guys were off tune or something.
There was this amazing moment in the class when we were trying to put together this Christmas song. And I'm a really good music teacher now, but in those days, I really wasn't. And we had like a $10 Casio keyboard. I had no equipment. And we were trying to plunk out this Christmas song, and it was a fifth, sixth grade split classroom. So, of course, the sixth graders and I were trying to hang out a couple of notes. It was all bad. And this tiny little kid in the back of the room, after half an hour of failure, goes, guys, you need to play an E and F sharp and a G. And everybody's heads went up. And I said, how did you know that? And she said, well, I have perfect pitch. And she walks up to the front of the room without any music in front of her, plays the entire song with two hands, and then announces, but the problem, Rafe, is this is a song being sung by 25-year-old men. Your class cannot sing in this key. We have to rewrite it like this, and then plays it again. And everybody in the class is looking at each other, absolute shock. And I said, why didn't you say something? And she said, well, you know, I'm only a fifth grader, and I really didn't want to take away the attention from the sixth graders because I'll have my time next year. I thought, oh, my God. I've never seen this kind of graceful humility. And she and I, she was my vision. She was my muse to be that extraordinary and have such confidence that you don't have to show it. You know, when they talk about schools, a great school, you always see the film of the excited kids with their hands thrust in the air showing they know all the answer. And that's nice. But Joanne was so wonderful, she didn't have to tell everybody she knew the answer. She knew the answer. That's all that mattered.
Right.
And I thought, this is what a classroom should look like. I have to tell you, that's not in the book. She got married a couple years ago, and she's so devoted to my classroom. She's a PhD in music now from Northwestern, and she scores all the music from my class these days for our Shakespeare shows.
Excellent.
But the funniest thing was at her wedding, at the moment when the couple walks around and thanks people at the dinner tables, thank you for coming, Joanne walks over to me in her wedding dress and says, you know, Rafe, it's Saturday and our honeymoon starts Tuesday. If you need me to come in Monday to help with the class, I'd be – and I'm like, Joanne, it's your wedding night. You can take a night off. But she's very devoted to what we do in Room 56. But she was the muse for this excellence coupled with humility that I found so attractive. And it's now become absolutely the central theme of our classroom.
So humility has taken a big place. I get that.
I know it's not fashionable these days to be humble, but I think it's real attractive.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the 10 I don't know what you call them, because they're not, you say they're not rules, but they're something that you hand out at the start of school. We're going to talk about those. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. This, the other voice is Rafe Asquith. He's a fifth grade teacher at Hobart Elementary in L.A. and has been doing that and continues to do that now. It's the 29th year?
I'm going to be starting my 31st year next month.
Oh, I was right then. Okay.
There you go.
I was trying to calculate from the different biographies I saw. So 30 years at this point, 31 starting in September. His new book is Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans. And you can learn more at HobartShakespeareans.org. That's one word, Hobart Shakespeareans. And he'll be at Vroman's Bookstore this Thursday, July 25th, 7 p.m. You can find out information. Vroman's is in Pasadena. You can find out information about that at Vroman'sBookstore.com. You say, and it's interesting where we're just going from the how that young girl was a model for you. You say the number one rule of teaching is be the person you want the kids to be.
Mm-hmm.
Short question is, about how long did it take for you to get that one? And two, expand on that a bit.
I think it took me 10 years to figure that out. You know, I always joke with young teachers now that if you're screaming at the children to be nice, that's a mixed message, isn't it? Right? Okay. So, you know, people ask, because I'm real calm now. I mean, I never raise a voice. And people say, don't you get mad at the kids? Of course I get mad at them. There are days I want to throw them out the window. But it's not good teaching. It's bullying. And I've learned that it's more effective. You know, if I'm asking my children, and I do ask them to be good to each other, use the word respect before. There is an enormous amount of respect in my classroom. The kids have for each other, for our guests. And it has to start with me. So I show even my toughest kids. And believe me, I have kids who are not always golden drops of sunshine. But they're only 10. And it means that it's part of my job to find out how they get to that angry place, what's going on in their life. And by yelling at them to sit down and shut up, they're certainly not going to open up to me. And I joke with people, look, I'm almost 6 feet tall. I can get a 10-year-old to behave himself. I can put the fear of God into him. And he'll sit down and shut up, but that's not teaching. And it took me a while to figure out that if I want my kids to be nice, I got to be the nicest guy they ever met.
Well, one thing that also makes sense to me is that having said what you said before, that you realize the measurement, the assessment doesn't happen on the end of school year. It happens 10 years. And my guess is that when you first said that, it was probably a few years ago. My guess is now you'd say not just 10, but 20,
even more.
30.
Absolutely.
And maybe the assessment is in their kids.
Absolutely.
And you titled your first book, There Are No Shortcuts. And there's a story behind how you came up with that too, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And that – I really love that expression. And I want to talk to about also that it's been lost in translation sometimes that I want to explain. But the story came up that many years ago, one of the great cellists of the world pulled his kids out of private school in Beverly Hills because he heard about my class. And his name is Lynn Harrell. And he put his kids in my class, and we went to see him play at the Bowl. And I had some young cellists who could scratch out a couple of notes and, you know, heard this amazing cellist. And they were backstage with him, and they said, how did you get that good? And he said, well, there are no shortcuts. And I thought, wow, what a simple expression. But he talked about his sacrifice and his practice schedule and what he had to give up as a child to get to that level. And I thought, what a wonderful motto for my class. But here's where I'm a little bit sad when people say that expression. I'll tell you why. A lot of teachers put that up in their classrooms, and that's great. But then when I ask them, what does it mean? Just like you asked me, what does it mean? They will say to you, well, it means the kids have to work harder, that, you know, it takes a long time. And I say, that's all true. But what does it mean for the teacher? And some teachers think it's only for the kids. I think it's for all of us.
In other words, it's up in your room. You can see it, too.
It's the front of the room. It's what they stare at it all the time.
But I mean, and you
and
see
me,
it.
Too.
Yeah.
So that if my students don't master a skill, even though the schedule says on April 11th they're supposed to have it down, that's fine. This is a long journey. It's an important theme in my book. When we do a Shakespeare rehearsal, we play a baseball game, and I see the kids do 50 things wrong. We talk about one or two of them. They can't handle all that criticism in a day. And we save the other 48 lessons for another day because there are no shortcuts. In this fast food society where we want instant coffee and instant movies and instant gratification, I've never found instant education, Terrence. I think to be good at anything, I mean, you interview people brilliantly, but don't you think you're better at it now than you were 10 years ago? You get better with experience and practice. I think it's true for all of us. And I really want to make sure teachers know it applies to us as well as the children.
That's right. Your classroom, which room 56 at Hobart Elementary, and you refer to it as room 56, and it gets, you know, so room 56 has kind of got its own little little life sort of, but it also has kind of its own little culture and world. How again, I'm asking so many things in terms of how long it took, because that's the frame the book sets. How has that evolved? How has what people experience in that room evolved over the years?
Well, I think what's happened in the book I've written about when teachers feel that they're not being supported, there's this amazing support system a teacher of a long time will have, and that's the former students. The reason this class evolved was I have an army of former students who came back and gave me advice, who, as they went on to middle school and high school, said, hey, Rafe, we love this, but you know what? You really should have done this, or you really should have done that. They weren't being mean, but they realized years later where there were holes in what I had provided for them. Or maybe I got it right, and they said, hey, this really helped me. Keep doing this. I use it all the time. And I think it evolved mostly from feedback from the former students.
Wow.
There's a chapter in the book called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. You mentioned our website. I couldn't put together a website to save my life, but two of my former kids who are engineers from Berkeley said, you know, this will really help you, Rafe, and they take care of it.
Wow.
So that's how the classroom evolves, and I really encourage teachers, especially today, it's so easy with email and texting, stay in touch with your former kids. They're going to be the best support system you have.
Now, I'm not in touch. I don't have children of my own. My stepson is graduated and off to college. When you talk about that, about former students coming back, I don't remember when I was in school former students coming back very often. How rare is that? Because it does – I mean, what you say makes great sense, and it's partially – we already said that the most important thing is for you to model who you want them to be. These former students who come back in a way are just additional models at different stages, which has got to have enormous benefit for the kids just in their presence.
One of the failures I want to talk about, a huge failure on my part in my early years, really fell on my face. You mentioned it before, the idea that I used to get kids to a very high level, you know, kids reading well, calculating well. Hey, Rafe, you've done a good job. Bye-bye. Have a good life. And then I found out they didn't have good lives. So my wife came up with this brilliant idea, and we have a joke. She comes up with the ideas, and then I have to kill myself to make them happen. But I started a Saturday program where on Saturday morning, my former students who were middle school come back and study literature with me and Shakespeare and mathematics. And where the press gets it wrong is they say, isn't that nice? The kids come back to see Rafe. Terrence, they don't come back to see me. They don't care about me. They come back to be with each other.
Oh,
you mentioned Room 56. We have this community. And I will tell you that every day, and I mean this, after school around 3:30, the door opens, middle school kids, high school kids come back just to hang out, mentor the young ones. But they all tell me they feel better in that room. They might be in a middle school or high school where there's bullying, or school is not always a happy experience. We've all been there. Adolescence is tough. And they come back. There's an actual physical feeling in the room that you're safe here. Everybody knows your name, and everybody's going to treat you right, and there'll be a cold bottle of water for you, or somebody's going to be playing the guitar and singing a song, and they love it. And that has created the culture of the room. The former students, not me.
That is really interesting, because now you've answered two of the questions with the answer the former students.
Yeah, well, it's
very resource, important. A resource that my guess is just not taken advantage of.
I agree. And you know what? All teachers tell me, you know, we don't reach everybody, but all good teachers, they get those letters, you know, from the kid at Christmas, you know, hey, you mean a lot to me. I miss you. Well, then ask them for help. You know, we tell our kids, when you don't know something, ask for help. I ask for help all the time. You have no idea how much help I get. The joke in my room is all these people help me and I get all the credit, because it's actually true. So I have fellow teachers, people outside my classroom, and the former students themselves who do much more than I do. I just kind of open the door and close the door. I'm not the iconic center of attention in that room. I'm really not. And when teachers come up to me and say, oh, Rafe, you're just being humble. No, I'm being honest. I really simply try to work hard and be a nice guy. But when I don't know something, my fifth graders see me ask for help. Isn't that the model that we want them to see?
Absolutely.
Because we've all seen the kids who are afraid to ask questions, afraid to admit they don't know something. And because they see me screwing up all the time and constantly asking for help, they think, okay, it's okay to ask for help. It doesn't mean you're a stupid person. It means you don't know something. So you go to someone who does. It's a very important skill to model for young people.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Rafe Esquith, fifth grade teacher at Hobart Elementary in L.A. for nearly 30 years, about his latest book, Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans. And the book is set out that way. First chapters about the early years, including a good enough section on just the first day, and then as teachers evolve, and finally the veterans and master teachers and so on. And you can learn more at HobartShakespeareans.org, H-O-B-A-R-T, HobartShakespeareans, one word, .org. I want to get into those 10 things, Rafe, because to me they mean so much. And one of the thoughts I had about them is that you say there are no rules written anywhere on the walls of the classroom, but you hand out a sheet to kids before you call roll on the first day, and it contains 10 statements.
Yeah.
And can you take us through them? Because
sure.
I think really that sets the frame. And what I want to say is that the sense that I got, and I've written your previous books, we've talked on the show a few times, is that the focus is on these human beings
mm-hmm.
and the development of human beings
mm-hmm.
more than it is on any one subject, any one assessment, any one anything. And so to me, these are the you know, the foundation and the sort of the meat of what's going on in there.
As all good teachers know, never say I teach fifth grade. Never say I teach math. Say I teach students.
Yes.
Now, that's very – and you hit the nail right on the head. I think all teachers might want to think about, as they develop, creating what I call a personal decalogue. And whether you call it the Ten Commandments or whatever, and your 10 don't have to be my 10. We're all different. And that's the beauty, I hope, in teaching. I know they want us all to be exactly the same. And if you know your play Inherit the Wind, when they ask teachers to be silent butlers in the service of their school board, I certainly hope that doesn't happen. So before I go over some of these 10, I want to give a tip that I give in this book that's very effective with these 10. If you ask most kids in school who are doing anything, if they're doing math or an essay, and you ask the kid, why are you doing this? What do you think the kid will say? He'll say, because my teacher told me to do it.
That would be first,
probably. You know, that would be maybe sometimes they say, I don't know why I'm doing it. If you ask my students why they're doing something, they will look up at you and say, if I learn this skill, my life just got better. That's the theme of the class every day. We are here for your life, not for the test, not for a grade. These are skills that are going to make your life better. So, for example.
Well, before we jump in,
yeah.
How soon do they know that's what class is about?
That class
is about your life being
better. It takes months. We say it on the first day. We say it on the second day. They don't internalize it right away. They're just a bunch of little kids.
And they know that's not what school's about. They've kind of gotten
fifth grade. They've been trained. So we have to untrain them. But then here's what happens. I'll give you an example. One of the things in our class is Hobart Shakespeareans are organized. I think if you're organized, your life's going to be better. And I'm talking about your things, your time, your thinking. But I also tell the kids it takes practice. You can't just magically snap your fingers and be organized. Every subject I teach, it doesn't matter whether it's math or baseball, we're organized. I tell the kids when we're playing baseball, think about it. You got to have your batting order. You have to know who's playing shortstop. You have to know where the gloves and bats and balls go after you've played, so they'll be there for you the next day when you want to play again. If we're organized, our baseball games are better, and our life is better. When we do mathematics later on, we want to know where the protractors are. We want to know where the calculators are. We want our numbers to be lined up in a certain way, not to impress anybody. You're going to get closer to the right answer if your numbers are neat and organized. If you understand math and understand how to organize your math, when you are buying a car and you want to know how much trunk space there are, when you're renting an apartment and you want to see if your closet is large enough and has large enough volume to handle the clothes that you have, your life's going to be better. So we're organized in our mathematical thinking.
And those kinds of examples that you just threw off, a closet, a trunk.
Right.
You're without saying this is so your life gets better over and over again, you just throw out that stuff.
Every day.
That everything that you're doing in the classroom as often as you can.
With every lesson, literally. You know, before we do math, and I always joke, you know, the typical math lesson is, boys and girls, we're going to learn multiplication today, and here are your 500 multiplication problems. And I always laugh and think, look, if a kid can do 10, why make him do 500? And if he can't do 10, why in the world would you make him do 500?
That's right. That's even stupider. Yeah.
I think let's do fewer problems, but do them well. And with the extra time, let's talk about why we're here. Most teacher books are about what we do. This book that I've written is about why we do it. The kids buy into what I'm working on, not because I'm such a cool teacher or so interesting. I'm actually pretty ordinary. They are not working for me. They start to realize we're working for ourselves. And then, part two, when they meet those older students who are coming back from Princeton and Berkeley and UCLA and say, you know, I was in Rafe's class and he really knew what he was talking about. My little students listen to the former students much faster than they listen to me. Kids who speak their languages, who came from their streets, they are the end result.
They're the embodiment of your life gets better.
And sometimes we as teachers and parents, we have a vision for what the kids can be, but they don't have that vision. And how can they? If their parents never went to higher education, if their parents are struggling working three jobs to get food on the table, we can't expect a 10-year-old to have the vision that we have. So, you know, another part of the personal decalogue is that Hobart Shakespeareans are aware of time and space. People are amazed that my classroom is very quiet. We never have a noise problem. I never have to shush them or anything. But there's no sign that says, be quiet. I never tell them to shut up or anything. But we talk about time and space a lot. And I ask the children, would you make a lot of noise in a hospital? And the kids all say, no. And I'll ask them, well, is that because there's a sign that says, be quiet? And with some real thinking, the kids start to say, well, there are sick people here. There are nurses trying to help them get better. If we were making noise in the hospital, we'd be disturbing them. And then I'll ask them, so you're saying noise is bad? And then the kids have to realize, well, not always. You have a playground, you have a beach, you have the park, scream your head off. But my students really now look around at their surroundings and they realize in a classroom, we're all going to understand the material better if it's quiet, not because anybody should. And it's not silent. During math time, everybody's talking about their math and buzzing about their math. And during history, they're always arguing about, you know, if Lincoln did the right thing during the Civil War, that's fine. But they don't get off point because they're aware of the time and the space. That's why I just came back from a trip with the kids. We did this fantastic John Steinbeck trip where the kids read four novels by Steinbck over the year. And we spent a week in Salinas and Monterey, went to Cannery Row, went to the Steinbeck Center up there.
Let me just ask you a quick informational question. Yeah. The kids. This kids from your fifth grade or to some these of were the older
these,
kids?
These were the older kids on Saturdays who read with me.
Okay.
And they wanted to read Steinbeck, so they read Grapes of Wrath. And we're coming up on the 75th anniversary of its publication. They read Of Mice and Men. They read Cannery Row. They read Travels with Charlie. So when they went up there, they really knew what they're looking at. And when we go to hotels with an army of kids and just my wife and me, there's no chaperones. And people come up to us all the time. Your kids' behavior in a hotel is unbelievable. They're so quiet. They're so polite because it's a hotel. They are aware of time and space. They see that people are trying to sleep or have a romantic dinner. They don't want to be disturbed by a bunch of 12-year-olds running around. But when we went across the street in Cambria on the beach, we had the most hilarious water balloon fights and burying each other in sand and just being outrageously silly and stupid, which I think is great for kids to be, but in time and place. So this personal decalogue, you ask a great question. No, they don't get it the first day. That's the Hollywood movie version.
Right.
But in that no shortcuts theme, if they hear it consistently every day and they start to realize, you know what? My life really will be better. Because if I understand time and space, I'll be able to go to the theater. I'll be able to work in library without anybody bothering me. But when I feel like letting my hair down, I know there are places to do that too.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. Let me look at a couple more on this list. Hobart Shakespearean Show Initiative.
Great.
That's a big one, especially I want to remind people we're talking about fifth graders, mostly 10-year-olds.
There's a key to this. First of all, why don't kids show initiative? I can't tell you how many classes I've been taken to, even award-winning famous classrooms, and you see the kids 100% of the time looking at their teacher, looking at their teacher. What do I do? And if the teacher says it, they'll do it. But I don't think that's going to help them years later. Here's a frightening statistic. Do you know that if you took all the freshman kids in college today, our best students, these are the kids who made it to college. They passed their exams. They did everything right. Do you know what percent finished college?
Let me guess. 45.
Less. It's more like 25.
Oh, God.
Now, how could that be? They're obviously smart. They know how to write papers. They know how to study. But they have no understanding of independence. They don't know how to make decisions. We haven't prepared them. So there was a great moment this year. The reason why don't kids show initiative? Because they're afraid they're going to make a mistake. They're afraid somebody's going to say, hey, who told you you could do that? In my classroom, they find out real fast, it's really okay to make mistakes. We all make them all the time. In the Shakespeare program, we had a great moment this year. We have a really sophisticated sound system with a full-blown band. And we're right in the middle of doing The Tempest, and the sound system went out. And just absolutely dead. And it wasn't electric power. All the electricity was running. Something was wrong. Three of the kids, and this is with a crowd there, talk about pressure. Three kids walked on stage, looked at the wiring in 30 seconds, reprogrammed all the simulation, sound back on, and the show went on again. And all the people looked over at me and said, that was better than Shakespeare. Watching these kids problem solve without looking at you, and they said, were they assigned to do that? I said, no. I said, we don't even have anybody to do that role. But all the time in the class, the kids realize we're allowed to do things. We can go, you know, kids always ask, like, is it okay if I read ahead? Why are you asking me? Of course you can read ahead.
Well, you even say that very early on, is it okay if I go to the bathroom?
Right. I mean, kids ask, can I go to the bathroom? Why are you asking me? Because, as you alluded to earlier, because they've been trained that you have to ask for everything. And then I will have this conversation with them where I say, are you really going to go to the bathroom? Or are you going outside to fool around? And the kids, well, I'm really going to go to the bathroom. I got to go. And I love this part because I ask them, what would happen if you said you were going and I found out that you were messing around? And the kids always say, it means you won't let us go to the bathroom anymore. And I say, no, absolutely you can go to the bathroom, but I'm going to have to send somebody to watch you because you've broken my trust. And our classroom is not based on fear. You know, you're talking about mistakes. The one mistake you don't get to make, that broken trust. Because once you lie, it's hard to get that trust back. It's really
hard.
Yeah,
no, I was going to go to that. That one of the things I found interesting in the book is you say almost anything, is redeemable.
We tell the truth.
The thing that breaks the thing is dishonesty.
Yeah. I mean, we got to tell each other the truth. It's totally okay to say, Rafe, I know you explained the math, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Rafe, I forgot my homework. Rafe, I spilled the paint. This year, I had a kid trip and step through a $2,000 guitar and break it into pieces. And no trouble at all. It was a mistake. Am I happy that we lost a $2,000 guitar? Of course not. But this kid didn't get up in the morning and play. It happens. Sometimes we trip. I've tripped, you know?
Yeah.
So
one of the things, by the way, when you talked about the three kids coming up and fixing the sound system like that,
yeah.
What I got as I was listening to it is you couldn't do that in 30 seconds if you had anxiety.
That's right.
Or if you had panic, or if you had we're in front of people. Oh, we got to do this fast. Any of those things would actually make it slower.
But here's the beautiful thing. We're talking about why we're here. When we do a Shakespeare play, we're not trying to impress the audience. We already know we're good, okay? We're not worried about blowing our lines or anything like that. We just know we have a show to do. And if the show's not working, fix the show. And like you said, nobody's looking at a clock. But that attitude, it's interesting. You mentioned earlier about my class affecting more than just my class.
Right.
We are incredibly famous in China. I have been to China now 5 times, and I actually have to have bodyguards because I have teacher fans that stalk my hotel. It's insane. But what those kids can't do, the Chinese kids, I think, have more discipline than our kids. They work incredibly hard. But I've watched them perform. If the slightest thing goes wrong, I mean the wheels come off the wagon.
Ah.
And all the teachers pile out and fix everything. Because these kids, and the joke I always tell the Chinese teachers, and they agree with me, they can mass produce better than any country in the world, but we're the ones who invent the iPad. They work so hard, but we're the ones who win the Nobel Prizes. And it's because we show initiative, because we create, and because sometimes we fall on our face, which is fine. And that's a very important
thing.
Now,
by the way, you're saying we show initiative, we have invention, and my guess is that some of the stuff we said at the top of the show about the current orientation toward testing and covering every minute and not allowing – I mean, how – if you are on a very tight schedule to teach the test, where is the room for initiative?
I agree.
That thing that has been our strength as a nation, as a culture, I wouldn't say we're teaching it out of kids, but more like the word you use, we're training them out of it.
Right. But here's what I'm always begging teachers to think about. If you're a teacher and you're incredibly frustrated with the way things are going, and if you are – like we have this new thing now called the Common Core Curriculum. For you people who are listening who don't know, it's the latest Stalin-esque five-year plan. It's Orwellian in its language, and it's not going to help Johnny Reed. But what I'm saying to teachers, if you're frustrated, as I know you are, can you imagine how the kids feel? Getting up in the morning, going to a place which is supposed to be fun, which learning should be joyous and exciting.
It was until they got to school?
Right. And what I'm saying is we are needed more than ever now to be a buffer, because you always hear about the bad students. But Terrence, I'm telling you, there are so many good kids who are dying to go through doors if we open them. And I'm begging teachers not to give up for the sake of those students that we got into teaching for the first place.
Right. One thing I need to ask you about, because actually I've read comments, like you've made an appearance and there are comments, or there's been a review of your book and then there are comments. I don't know if you've done this.
I never read comments.
Okay. But it's amazing how many are from teachers. And in this one section I read, how many of them say, well, he can't have a normal life. You're the father of four, grandfather of two.
Sure.
And when asked in your previous book, Who Lights Your Fire? Your answer was your wife, Barbara.
Yeah.
Yet when I look at online comments, as I just said, they assume you have to be giving your family short shrift, that the time you devote to your students must take away from your family. Speak to that.
Well, I actually did in this book. I wrote in the book, the reason I don't write about my family, who'd be interested? But my four children were very close, and they're incredibly successful. I have a daughter with two PhDs from Johns Hopkins. She's a wonderful doctor. I have a daughter who's a lawyer out of Duke. I have a son who's an award-winning teacher at Alhambra High School. He coaches speech and debate. I have another son who's a computer whiz, and he's never allowed to leave Los Angeles because if something goes wrong for me, he has to be there for me. Two of them are very happily married. We have wonderful grandchildren. My secret, not giving my family short shrift, I don't watch television. So when I would come home at 5 or 6 at night, I spent time with my family as the kids were growing up. They're all grown now. If you were to ask me about the things that I hear people talking about, you know, the reality television shows, I have no idea what they're talking about. When I stand in line at the supermarket and you see the pictures of all the celebrities, I don't know who these people are. So that was my secret in my time management. But people are mistaken if they don't think I have a very close family. We're very close. And by the way, my students all know my family, which is one of the reasons why they respect me. They see the relationship. And a question I'm asked often, how did you raise your own children differently than your students? There is no difference at all. We read the same books. We have the same conversations, the same values. Atticus Finch is described as a man who is the same inside his house as outside his house. And I try to follow his example.
So it does still seem to me that time is a critical piece here. So
sure,
Cutting out TV. But my guess is you follow sports.
I do follow sports.
my big what's
Love
the
sports.
Word? That my big addiction. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know you do because it comes up so often. One thing that we have about 5 minutes left. Time. One thing I notice, and as we spoke just before I went on the air, I have yet to be in your classroom. We will fix that very soon.
Cool.
Is you don't hurry. But you get a lot done, but you start right away, but you talk a little bit about time, because my guess is I think a lot of what we're talking about applies outside the classroom, applies wherever you are. But this one is something that I think is a very tough nut for most people.
It's
today.
One of the reasons I actually have sections of the book that take you through minute by minute of my day. One of the things I want to say, especially to the younger teachers, you're absolutely right. In my early years of teaching, there was no time for anything. I was scrambling constantly. all teachers know about this. You go home because you're doing a project the next day and, oh my God, the supplies didn't arrive. So it's 9 o'clock at night and I'm out at Home Depot or Kinko's getting things done. But as you get better, you become more efficient. You know where supplies are. You know how to get them. You know who to call. You develop relationships with people who help you get what you need in the classroom. So these days, as a master teacher, I basically spend about 2 hours on a Sunday morning planning my week, and I'm good to go. When my class ends at 5 o'clock, I shut it down. And you were talking about slowing down. You know, when I was a younger teacher and there would be a problem, you would fret about it all night long and make the visit to the home to solve that problem. Really, most problems can wait till the next day. Sure, if you have a kid who's suicidal or somebody's gone missing, you have those rare circumstances, yes, you have to take away from your family. But the beauty of really getting good as a teacher, it's not that it gets easier, but you're more efficient. And I wrote about this in the book because time is a very serious issue. I just don't waste it.
And that doesn't exactly show up on this Decalogue. But my guess is, Hobart Shakespeareans are aware of time and space.
Yeah.
So it is.
We are. You know, even changing subjects in my class, when we switch from math to literature, takes 15 seconds. I just tell the kids time to change, and they know, let's not waste our time. And it's just that simple. I'm very good with time. I have Malcolm X always had a watch on his wrist. He never said, I'm 10 miles away. He would say, I'm 15 minutes away. He measured his life in time. It's a very big issue in life. And I think a good teacher becomes better at balancing the time with their family. And the people who think I don't have a close family life, they are mistaken. I could never do what I do without the support and love of my entire family.
Yeah. Let's sum up now. So you say that all children can be extraordinary. My guess is that that would mean a lot of teachers can be extraordinary.
No question.
And a lot of classrooms could be extraordinary. What would you say to people listening, whether if they're teachers or parents, what's step one, step two, step three to begin to turn?
We have to change the conversation we have. We are in a society where the Kardashians are more important than people curing cancer. I have a conversation with my class every year, and this might offend your listeners. You know, here we are in Los Angeles where Kobe Bryant is a hero. Not to me, he's not. He's a phenomenal basketball player, one of the best ever. But if you look at his behavior and what he's done, and the fact that even his teammates don't want to play with him, I wouldn't call this man a hero. Great basketball player. A hero, maybe your mom who makes dinner for you every night. Someone like Meep Geese who protected Anne Frank and risking her life when she was 17 years old. And many of the teachers who go into those classrooms every day under terrible circumstances and still try to help children. Those are heroes. I think step one is we have to change what our students value. We have to look at our own values. And that's why Room 56 is different. We value things that are different from the mainstream culture of America.
Is there a support group around this kind of stuff at this point?
Well, I think there is in your fellow teachers. I don't think society will ever value what we do. There's a hilarious story at the end of the book where I talked about when I was the National Teacher of the Year and I gave my first speech, they put me up not in a hotel, but in a garage, laying down under a ping pong table with fresh cobwebs hanging over my head. And I thought, my God, I'm the National Teacher of the Year. I wonder what the guy who finished second, where he is tonight. And I realized we're never going to get our due. My support system, all good teachers, we got to stick with this together. There's a chapter in my book called All for One, All for One, you know, where I have this team of teachers around me who are extraordinary, and we make each other feel good, and we laugh and cry together. I think we teachers have to look at each other. That's where the support is best.
And for parents?
I think the parents need to be as involved with schools as they can. And there's a chapter in the book, There's No Place Like Home. When teachers work with parents and parents help us out, you have successful children. And when we're fighting, the kids lose every time.
Okay. Again, the book is Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. The previous books, and I haven't read all, but I've read most. There Are No Shortcuts, Teach Like a Hair is on Fire, and Lighting Their Fire. The website is hobartshakespeareans.org. That's Hobart Shakespeareans. I'll spell it this time. Shake. Spear, S-P-E-A-R, and then E-A-N-S, HobartShakespeareans.org. Thank you, Ray Vasquith. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.